Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang are just underway as I record this. While you watch them, you'll be regaled with plenty of stories about the mighty, the cocky, the badass. But it's worth remembering that, cliche or not, appearances can be deceiving. Take, for example, skater Dorothy Hamill. In 1976, she gracefully glided and leapt, double-axled and salchowed her way into America's heart. My goodness, she had a hairdo named after her. And yet, behind the scenes, she didn't feel like America's sweetheart at all.
Usually go into the bathroom and throw up. I really would get violently ill. So I never ate very much before I competed because I couldn't keep it down. And I often thought it was really like going to your own execution. You know, from the time I got up in the morning, you know, I'd be looking at the clock saying, okay, I've only got 12 hours until I'll be finished, and then 9 hours till I'm finished, and 5 minutes from now I'll be finished. It was just, I couldn't wait till it was over.
Then there's Scott Hamilton, the 1984 gold medalist and four-time world champion.
When I won Worlds, I was devastated. I thought, I'm a world champion? What's wrong with the sport? If I can win the Worlds, this is like a bad time for figure skating. And then I tried to live up to the expectations or my image of what a world figure skating championship should be, and it drove me crazy. I never could live up to that, the image that I had preceding my world championship. Those are for other people. Those are for the great skaters of the past, like Dick Button and Hayes Jenkins and David Jenkins. Those are world champions. I'm a, you know, this short jerk from Ohio. What am I doing winning world championships? So I really, it was devastating because it brought the whole notion, the whole image of world champion kind of down and my mind, and it took me a long time to get used to the fact that, well, now is my time.
On this episode of What It Takes, in honor of the 2018 Winter Olympics, we bring you two oh-so-real stories from legendary figure skaters, Dorothy Hamill and Scott Hamilton, ordinary people with ordinary demons and extraordinary accomplishments. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance, from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Before we jump out onto the ice, I want to let you know we've got a new handle, #WhatItTakesPod. We are so grateful to our regular listeners, and if you're listening for the first time, welcome. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Now, as I indicated at the top, this Winter Olympics episode is oddly lacking in bravura. I don't know about you, but I kind of assumed that people who make it to the Olympics and then win gold medals know just how great they are. But Olympians are mere mortals, it turns out, and confidence is not always a necessary ingredient for success. We start with Dorothy Hamill. She grew up in a Norman Rockwell kind of Connecticut town in the 1960s, stopping at the penny candy store on her way home from school, etc., etc. But she didn't fit in.
I think my shyness had a lot to do with it. My brother was very gifted as a student. Both my brother and sister are older. And my sister was very social, and she had all the friends and boyfriends. And I always just always felt stupid. Didn't like school at all. Partly because I wasn't very good at it. If I had a teacher that I liked, I did well. Mostly I had teachers that expected me to be brilliant like my brother. And I wasn't. Because it was such a small town. You know, brother was smart, sister was a little less smart. And then I came along and I was the moron. Still am, but anyway, at least I found something that I can do.
Ow. Yeah, I'm just going to stop here and acknowledge it is painful to hear anyone be so self-denigrating, let alone someone who was a hero to many people. Dorothy Hamill recorded this interview with the Academy of Achievement in 2000. It was 7 years before she would go public about her struggles with depression and 8 years before her breast cancer diagnosis. The focus of the interview was on her early life and her path to greatness, but it was a fraught path, and the prize at the end, I think, turned out not to be the gold hanging from a ribbon around her neck, but the act of skating itself. Hamill remembers the first time she put on ice skates. They were her brother's, and she had to stuff socks into them to make them fit.
It was on a pond in old Greenwich, Connecticut. And I went with my sister and my neighbor, just the three of us, and they were skating backwards, and they just completely left me in the dust. And I wanted to learn how to skate backwards, and they wouldn't help me, and they went off and left me on my own. And of course, I went crying home to my mother's, up the hill with my skates on my shoulder. Mom, they won't teach me how to skate backwards. So I think I must have put on this crying thing for a long time, probably a week or so. And my mom finally said, okay, you know, would you like to take some skating lessons? And I said, yes, I'd love to. I want to learn how to skate backwards. And I was hooked.
She was 8 and a half, old by today's standards.
But fortunately in those days, there weren't as many skaters. And, you know, I was just driven. I was passionate. I found something that I loved. I could be all alone in the big old skating rink and nobody could get near me, and I didn't have to talk to anybody because of my shyness. It was great. I was in my fantasy world.
What do you think the teachers saw in you that made them think that here was someone with potential as an ice skater?
That's interviewer Irv Drasnan, who sat down with Hamill at the Academy of Achievement Summit in 2000.
Well, I don't really think they saw anything in me, except the fact that I was interested in it. Where some of the other kids, you know, they would miss a week here and miss a week there. I think they could see that I really enjoyed it. Because I wasn't particularly athletic or gifted. You know, I was a little chubby, and but I loved it. And I guess because my mom would take me to the skating rink on the weekends. This is after I'd gotten started. She'd drop me off for the first public session at 11 in the morning, and I'd stay there all day. And she'd pick me up at 5 o'clock and take me home. So I'd be at the skating rink all day long, just skating around and around.
When Dorothy Hamill was about 10, her mom took her to see Holiday on Ice in New York City. And the next year, Peggy Fleming won the gold medal at the 1968 Olympics, the only American to take home gold that year. Hamill had already started to compete at rinks larger than her hometown pond, but now she started to set her sights higher.
I mean, you realize that despite your shyness, you were going to have to compete in front of people and judges.
Didn't realize that. I was ice skating. I was just ice skating. I had no concept of that. Especially in those days, you couldn't see the judges. You know, I was this little person on the ice, and there were just people that would stand around the boards because that's what skating was all about in those days. So it could have been my mother and it could have been judges. I didn't even know where the judges sat. It's so different now.
It was also different in her day because there was no financial support available for athletes training for the Olympics. They were truly amateurs, so the burden fell entirely on families. For Dorothy Hamill's parents, that was a hardship. So they spent what they could and then some, and they supported her in other ways too.
There was never any question that I wouldn't do it. And I guess my parents must have seen that. And also, they were probably thinking, well, what else is she going to do? But when I started getting very serious about it, my mother got up at 4 a.m. I give her so much more credit today. You know, at the time, I was just a kid. Well, that's what, you know, mom's doing. She got up and she'd make breakfast for me and bring it up to me in bed and wake me up and lay my clothes out and help me put them on. Then she'd go warm up the car. And, you know, in the wintertime, it was freezing outside. She'd go down and start the car so I get into a warm car. I mean, she treated me like a little princess. And it was what I wanted to do. I didn't really, a couple of the kids asked me today, you know, do you feel as though you missed out on anything in childhood because of your sacrifices? And absolutely not. I loved it. Skating was the perfect excuse not to have to go to friend's house, you know, a friend's house for a sleepover. And I, you know, I think a lot of that was the shyness. But my mom sacrificed. I didn't sacrifice anything. I just was passionate, you know. It's all that passion. My father was very musical. That really was his passion, but when he grew up, you know, the oldest male child wasn't a musician. You know, they got a real job and they went to school and they got a good education. But deep down inside, his love was music. And if he could have been Betty Goodman or Glenn Miller, because he had his own band, he composed music and at Princeton in school. That was his real love. So musically, my father educated me. We would sit together and listen to records and pick music for skating programs, skating routines. And so we had a very, very close relationship there. And then he got weekend duty of driving me to the skating rink at weekends, I think it was 5. A little later.
This is the music that Dorothy Hamill chose for her Olympic freestyle routine in Innsbruck, Austria.
Do you remember when you first, when it first dawned on you that you could be somebody, that you could win these things?
No. The first competition I ever won was the second competition I ever competed in. It was in Central Park in New York. And I remember the little girls who, you know, had perfect dresses and they'd been skating for years and they all knew one another. And I came, they were all from Long Island and in Manhattan, and I was from Connecticut and there was nobody else that I knew. And when the scores went up on the board, on the wall, they all looked at me and pointed and said, "You won," you know, and I was shocked because I wasn't as good as they were. So I don't know how I won. And I think, you know, I never liked competition ever. It was always far too nerve-wracking. But I did well, so I guess that's why I kept doing it. We all say this, but it's true. You know, you just want to go out and skate well. I just never wanted to embarrass myself. You know, it's just, it didn't matter if I won or not. You know, you hope that your best is better than everybody else's best. But, you know, you're out there. I was always out there competing against myself. Because there were so many more skaters that were much more talented than I. I think the reason I won the Olympics was sheer perseverance, not because I was certainly not more talented than anybody else. You know, I worked as hard as I could. I always thought, you know, I was always the first one on the ice and the last one off. And I'm just one of those people that has to be overtrained and overworked before I can do my best. And that's unlike a lot of my friends and colleagues today. But So, you know, it was just sheer perseverance. I was not the most talented. Still am not the most talented. It's just, whatever I've done has just come through hard work, really, and the love of it and the passion for it.
Crowds loved watching Dorothy Hamill, her rosy glow, her innovative combination spin dubbed the Hamill Camel, her little "who me" shrug of the shoulder as she received her medal. Never a showy wave, never a gutsy stare into the camera. But didn't winning the gold, becoming a celebrity, and having her hairdo spark a national trend cause her confidence to blossom? Not really.
Well, I'm better in a one-on-one situation, but I still have my moments where even then, sometimes I just absolutely freeze because I'll be completely in awe of people. And in the beginning, people took it as if I was aloof or a snob or something, but I literally just would freeze. I felt I had nothing to say to anybody that anybody wanted to hear. And, you know, what is so ironic is that by winning a gold medal, you're thrown into the spotlight, and having it first thing after winning a gold medal, after blood doping, there's a press conference, and all of a sudden there are swarms of reporters. And the first question the reporter that I remember somebody asking me was, how are you going to top that? And I thought, Jiminy Christmas. You know, a lifelong goal of mine to win an Olympic gold medal, well, lifelong, you know, I guess from the time I was 13 or something. And I actually did it. And now they're going to say, how are you going to top that? I don't know. And what do I say? Besides being painfully shy, I was stunned. It was just, whoa, is this what it's all about? It was just not at all what I expected.
What happened next wasn't what she expected either, Hamill told Irv Drasnan. Her mother hadn't come to the arena to watch her Olympic performance. Instead, she stayed back at the hotel, chain-smoking, a fact that pained Dorothy Hamill for years.
My mom, I remember walking into the hotel room and going, and she said, so, how did you do? And I said, I won. And she looked at me, startled, and said, you did? She was shocked. She never congratulated me. I think she just never thought I would do it. But my dad, of course, was very proud. And I'm sure my mother was proud. I just didn't know. I think the whole thing, you know, finally, I guess about 4 years before the Olympics, the goal was to try and make it to the Olympics and hopefully maybe win a medal. And then all of a sudden, when that actually happens, It's disconcerting. I mean, now what? What happens now? We didn't plan for that, you know. We planned for everything up until that moment. And then, now what? It was an interesting time.
Her parents couldn't afford to keep her training up for the 1980 Olympics. They were in debt. But Dorothy Hamill did stay on to compete at the World Championships the following month, because she'd always come in second there, but now it seemed within reach.
30 seconds to go on her performance, Dick.
And if she can just hold this till the end, she will have this competition without a doubt. Split jump, she's loose, she's got a smile on her face, she's been with it since the moment she stepped on the ice. Two splits, now watch this final line camel, she's at the end of that program, and Chris, she's got her. Watch her drop now, a back move, a Hamill camel, tap the ice, a back sit spin, a move that she invented, and a final scratch pin, and that's it for Dorothy Hamill.
Like she did
right
in
there.
Innsbruck. Fulfilling an 11-year-old dream.
Dorothy Hamill, USA.
Dorothy Hamill received here, American flags waving on the far side. Plenty of representatives.
Dorothy Hamill did prevail that year. Then she became a paid professional skater with the Icecapades.
Once you achieve that lifelong goal, at the age of 19, you think that everything's going to be easy. and it's only just begun. The road really had just begun. If I'd known then what I know now, well, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. So, I mean, just everything from the time I turned professional and showed up for my first day of ice skating at Ice Capades, and, you know, having, I had put on a few pounds, you know, after going to the Olympics and going to Worlds. I took a vacation for the first time in my life. And I was just enjoying, you know, winning the gold medal, and people were wining and dining me and taking me, you know, I was agents and managers and endorsements and all that stuff. And I was just having a great time. I put on a few pounds. I showed up at rehearsal, and one of the line skaters went over to one of his friends and said, "Honey, if I got to skate around her, you better call me a cab." And that's how, that was my introduction to the world of professional skating. It was entirely different than what it is today, of course. And it, you know, I ended up in the hospital with a bleeding ulcer after 6 months in the ice show. I was skating 13 shows a week. I was getting up at, you know, 6 o'clock to do AM, you know, podunk wherever we were. And the reporters saying, "Well, if, you know, we're not going to cover the ice show unless we can have Dorothy to interview." And here I am shy. You know, what am I going to say? I have nothing to say. I just am a dumb ice skater. If you want to ask me about ice skating, I can tell you about skating. But don't ask me about anything else, because I don't know anything else. You know, for all the hours I trained, for, you know, all the double axels I did, I didn't go to school. I didn't read. I didn't, you know, learn about anything else. And it was very difficult. It was very difficult. I was completely unhappy. You know, here's something that I loved doing. I must say I was probably burned out as well from skating. And, you know, I didn't really have a chance to enjoy my Olympic victory. I did for about a month before I had to go back and skate in the show. And it was a completely different way of ice skating. There was no training anymore. I was lucky if I got 45 minutes a day to practice. And I was away from my friends. I was, you know, every week you're in a different city, living in hotels. You know, and the other thing is I was used to getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and skating every day. And now I'm up till midnight skating ice shows. And for my whole life I had gotten up at five. And now all of a sudden, you know, I'm trying to learn how to sleep later on the days that I don't have to do those early morning talk shows. But it just, my whole schedule, and I mean, it was just, if I'd get up in the morning to do an early show, I'd try and go home and nap in the afternoon. I could never do that. It was just changed everything that I'd ever done.
Dorothy Hamill was the headliner for the Ice Capades for 8 years until it folded. A number of years after that, she and her then husband bought the company's assets and tried to revive the show, but times and tastes had changed and the venture failed.
We all fail. And, you know, in this great game of life, you just don't know what curveball is going to be thrown your way. Everybody, you know, it's not easy. Life is not easy. When I won the Olympics and I thought, oh gosh, now, you know, I'm going to be able to get my dad out of debt. I'm going to be able to pay for, you know, buy my mom a house, or, you know, doing all those things. Thought everything would be just rosy. And I had just started. So, you know, all those failures build character.
She went on to skate with other companies and do television specials. She married 3 times and raised a daughter. In 2008, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And after she survived, she became an advocate for women's health. And through it all, she's always skated.
I think it's good to have something that you love in times of trouble or hard times. It's carried me through a lot. Skating has. So it's my release. It's my therapy.
Which brings us now to Scott Hamilton. Shyness was never his issue, but like Dorothy Hamill, he found skating to be a refuge from the things that were painful in his life.
I was adopted because my parents had trouble having children. My sister is of my parents, and my brother and I were both adopted. Grew up kind of blessed with loving parents and a great household. And around the time I was 2 or 3 years old, it's all pretty mysterious, I stopped growing. And my parents noticed that I wasn't developing like the other children, and it scared them a great deal, because without knowing your family history, medical history, you really don't know how to react or what to expect, you know, from your adopted children. So I went in and out of hospitals for a long period of time. I was misdiagnosed many, many times, once as cystic fibrosis and another time as Shwachman syndrome, which is a pancreatic enzyme deficiency. Basically what I had was a paralyzed or a non-effective intestine system where I wasn't absorbing the food that I was eating. And what ended up happening was we just in and out of hospitals, and finally we went to see Harry Shwachman in Boston, and he said, it's not Shwachman syndrome. We've run every test. We can't find anything wrong with him. Let him lead a normal life and see what happens. I was on all these restricted diets and everything else. So after years and years and years of living in hospitals and being away from other kids and not growing and not developing, I went home to live a normal life, and part of that was going to the skating rink every Saturday morning with our family doctor's kids.
That was in Bowling Green, Kentucky, where he grew up and where his dad was a professor. Scott Hamilton was 9 years old.
And it was one of those things that I could do probably better than the kids that were really tall and you know, really muscular and everything else. And it gave me a way to express myself a little bit, just in the way that I could make my own schedule. I could determine my own development on the ice and improvement. And it gave me some self-esteem that I didn't have growing up, because I was the shortest one in the class and sick and couldn't really compete with, couldn't play all those reindeer games, I guess. So I started skating, and the illness completely went away. So I was going out there every Saturday, and I just picked it up, and I improved rapidly. And it was just something that I did. I didn't really think that I was gifted, or I didn't really think that I was super talented. I was just lucky to have a body that was the right proportion to pick up skating moves, and I was pretty agile. And the fact that I like to show off and be the center of attention really lends itself to figure skating very well. But I never really thought that I would be extraordinarily successful at skating. It's just something that happened.
In other words, the Olympics theme music didn't start echoing in his ear the minute he first laced his skates.
No, it wasn't like he looked across the room and saw skates glowing in the corner. He stepped out of his wheelchair, and it was a miracle. It wasn't anything like that. It wasn't like Hollywood. I started skating, and I kind of liked it because I could run circles around the guys that wouldn't pick me to play baseball. We don't want him. He's too short. He can't hit the ball over second base. But I could skate circles around him. And I ended up playing hockey just out of peer pressure. So I played hockey for 3 years, and I did quite well. It's just a big man's sport, you know, and I really was undersized. And so figure skating was a great vehicle for me to kind of be competitive at something without having to be big and without having to, you know, be in contact with somebody else. It was just something I did and I liked. And what was really funny is, as I got older, all the guys were calling me a sissy in junior high school, which I was their best friend because they wanted to meet all the girls that I knew in figure skating. So it was like I went from na-na-na-na-na, and the next year I was like, you know that little blonde from Cleveland? I go, yeah. Can you get me a date with her?
By high school, Scott Hamilton was entering competitions and winning. But skating was getting in the way of schooling. He was a B and C student mostly, he said during this interview with the Academy of Achievement in 1996. By his senior year in high school, the year he won the National Junior Championship, he didn't have enough credits to graduate.
And I went into my principal of the school, and I said, well, you're about a credit and a half short, and you're going to need to figure out what we're going to do with, you know, how are we going to get you out of this high school? And I said, well, I tell you what, I'm threatening you right now. If you don't give me PE credit, I'm coming back next year. And he said, that's enough for me. We don't want you back. So I got PE credit, which they never gave me because I was skating all the time, and they figured, well, you won a national title. I guess you're physically educated. So I just barely graduated high school.
Skating was a strain on his family's finances, just as it had been for Dorothy Hamels. So Scott Hamilton enrolled in Bowling Green State University, and he considered dropping skating altogether. But then things took a turn in his life.
The biggest, I guess, occurrence, the biggest happening, most important thing that for my skating was the commitment I made after my mother passed away. She did so many things for me throughout her life. She was a second grade school teacher. She needed to make more money to keep me in skating because it was very expensive. So she went back to school, was working full time, and all that time she was suffering from cancer, you know, surgeries and chemotherapies and radiation, everything. It was pretty devastating on her physically and emotionally, you know, when your life is being threatened, but at the same time you're looking ahead to the next job, to the next, you know, the next level of income. And she really worked hard. She went back to school. She got her master's. She became an associate professor. She was a counselor in marriage and family relations, which meant that she had to face her illness pretty much every day with her work, with people that she was counseling and with their problems, whether it be some sort of marital problem or health or whatever. She stayed very well focused and held the family together as well at home. And the strongest person I've ever known. When she passed away, I kind of understood the commitment that she made to make sure that I could stay in skating. And I wanted to live up to whatever I could, not so much win everything, but just to be the best that I could possibly be, to honor her memory and everything she went through, to make sure that I was given the opportunities to be the best that I can be, not to be a world champion or an Olympic gold medalist, but to be the best that I could be. And it was that was the most important thing that ever happened in my career. Then I decided I was going to take it seriously. Before then, I was just improving and working hard and doing the best that I could do. But it really, there was no force behind it. It was just something I did. I think that if you believe in the spirituality of a life force that is constant and forever, I think I absorbed a lot of her strength and a lot of her her passion to, you know, hold it together and to fight through whatever obstacles lay in front of you. And she, and you know, I always admired her strength and I always admired her courage. And without strength and courage, it's really hard to perform at the highest levels of international figure skating, because you're alone on the ice and you only have really 7 minutes over two nights to prove yourself. And if you make any mistakes, you're dead. So I really feel like a lot of the qualities my mother had and a lot of what she showed us with commitment and with integrity and perseverance, I absorbed some of that when she passed away, and it gave me what I needed to be successful in figure skating.
From the fall of 1980 to the spring of 1984, Scott Hamilton never lost a competition. He was the national champion and the world champion for 4 years running, and the feather in his cap, a gold medal at the 1984 Olympics in Sarajevo, the first gold by an American male figure skater in 24 years. Hamilton said there was one important difference between the world championship and the Olympics. At the world, you are there as an individual, representing yourself as you try to beat skaters from other countries. At the Olympics,
you are representing the United States. It's a different whole. It's the same skaters, same judges, same size of ice, same music, same everything, same format, same. But the one thing that is different is it's the Olympic Games, and you're sharing your successes and failures with everyone that's a U.S. citizen, and it's theirs. It belongs to them. So when I stood up in the podium and I get my medal and I get to hear my anthem and to see my flag raised, I'm the point person for millions and millions of people that can, for that moment in time, just feel pride that one of their own did okay. And you feel like you have 100 million parents and 100 million, you know, brothers and sisters, and you share it, and it makes the Olympics so magic. It's just an amazing thing to hear your anthem and to completely lose it. And if you know, people at home are losing it too, they're feeling the exact same emotions I was at that particular point in time, and it's their medal too. They share in it. Most other competitions are individual achievements, but the Olympic Games is something that belongs to everybody.
But the folks watching at home aren't really feeling the same emotions. At best, they're getting a dose of the elation, but not the rest of what Scott Hamilton and Dorothy Hamill and probably most Olympic athletes feel when they're on that riser receiving their medals.
You know, it's the joy of reaching your goal. It's the sadness that the goal is over. It's a feeling of triumph that you've won the day. It's a feeling of loss and emptiness because everything that you've ever worked for is now at an end, and you're looking over this chasm of what's next, and it's over. And that's the second they put the medal around your neck, that part of your life is over. And the process of getting there is so terrific. You know, all the sprains and strains and breaks and fractures and casts and bruises and disastrous performances and great performances, all that over, done. So it's great pride and it's emptiness and it's so conflicting, and they're at the same time. It's not like yay, huh? It's not like they're kind of trading places. You're feeling all that at once, and it's overwhelming. I mean, I couldn't control myself on the stand because I understood what had happened. I understood where I came from to get to there, and I understood how I was sharing it with everybody. But and as great as it was, it's over. And now where do I go? What am I going to do with myself? Everything that was my identity has now come to an end, and I'm lost.
For Scott Hamilton, becoming a professional skater after the Olympics was a bumpy ride. There were no commercials, no TV specials. He was admired, but he wasn't America's sweetheart. The Ice Capades hired him briefly, but then didn't know what to do with him. Figure skating was still considered a woman's domain. So Scott Hamilton forged his own way and a professional path for skaters after him by creating Stars on Ice, a touring show without the cartoon characters and the princesses. Stars on Ice was the perfect vehicle for Scott Hamilton. He was always known as a great showman, but without having to abide by competition rules or appeal to an international panel of judges, he was free to indulge his backward flips, his love of rock and roll, and his sly sense of humor. Online, you can watch him get down to Prince's hit Kiss or Aerosmith's Walk This Way. You can catch him in plaid knickers and wingtip skates, dragging a golf bag behind him and wielding a club like a twirler's baton. And you can see him gliding through a routine to music from the show Hair, wearing a hippie wig as a commentary on his own follicular challenges. No shortened, sassy hair phenom named after this guy. Everywhere that is, that is. Hamilton retired from Stars on Ice in 2001, a few years after he was treated for testicular cancer. But the show goes on to this day. And if you want to see Nathan Chen, Brady Tennell, Mirai Nagasu, Adam Rippon, and lots of your other favorites from this Winter Olympics and Olympics past, that's where you can catch them come April and May.
Everything that I've ever been able to accomplish in skating and in life has come out of adversity and perseverance. The judge that told me I was too short to compete on the international level. Well, I'll prove her wrong, and I did. Another judge who just didn't really like me that much and was very powerful, always throwing up roadblocks, trying to get me to fail. No, you can't. If you do this jump in competition, we're going to have to mark you down. So I'd change the jump, and I'd land a tougher jump and despite her, and I'd win the competition. So all the things that were meant to kind of pull me down made me better, just out of just drive and intensity and perseverance. It's always been just getting past the adversity, finding a challenge, meeting it, finagling, however you get around it, but always keep looking ahead. Don't let somebody grab a hold of the back of your shirt and hold you back. You know, just keep going, keep going. And without that kind of adversity, I'd be a much less of a performer. I'd love for people to throw up some roadblocks. It gives me direction and it gives me something to challenge and to beat.
In the 2 decades since this interview, Scott Hamilton has gotten more than his share. Not only testicular cancer, but also a benign brain tumor. Not once, not twice, but 3 times. He is married and has 4 kids, including 2 that he and his wife adopted from Haiti following the 2010 earthquake. He's currently in South Korea, providing commentary on the figure skating competitions for NBC. Dorothy Hamill just finished a run on stage in the play Go Figure about the life of her friend skater Randy Gardner. Of course, if your appetite for figure skating drama and pathos is unlimited, there's always I, Tanya. This is what it takes from the Academy of Achievement. Our next episode features that debonair leading man of stage and film, Jeremy Irons. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts and you'll never miss an episode. Happy listening. See you next time. I'm Alice Winkler.
Kiss.
Funding for What It Takes comes from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation.